Two things I'd like to announce. One is that tomorrow evening, we don't usually advertise a shiur, but tomorrow we want to try and get to the people who never come to shiurim. We're having a shiur discussion about the subject of the experience of becoming more involved in the Jewish way of life and the conflicts that arise usually with family. The classical situation is with parents who don't approve necessarily of a younger of a child becoming more fanatical, extremist, whatever the way they think about it. So we'd like to be able to understand. There's also other problems such as a marriage where the one of the couple is developing faster than the other. Many conflicts that arise internally in the person himself, with his family, work, and many different areas, very complex area of what happens when a person gets more involved with all the extremism that he usually generates and the complex relationships that he has with other people. So the reason that we are advertising the shiur widely is the people we want to come are those who are so upset about the whole thing that they don't come to shiurim. So we want those people to come and be able to hear perhaps another side of the picture, and they're also invited to ask questions. They can get things off their chest. We don't have questions usually on a Monday night, but that's what we'd like to try and do. The second thing is that there's a unique effort being made by the South African Jewish community to run a concert in aid of a very specific target in Israel, which is still to be exactly decided. Perhaps people who suffered in the recent rocket attacks, or perhaps people, Russians, who don't have places to live, but the target will be specifically denoted, and tickets will be on sale, I think, afterwards, being advertised too. We were studying together the laws of tshuva. And we got to the section, who's here for the first time? We were studying in the section, this is a classical area of the Rambam's famous work, in which he goes through from the beginning, the discussion begins with the subject of damage that a person has done to themselves, to friends, relationships, to the spiritual cosmic structure, and how a person can undo the damage that he's done in the past. From there, he leads in, right, into many concepts that are central to spiritual being, existence. And that's why we chose this section. He discusses the concept of balance of positivity and negativity that you've generated in yourself, what that means in terms of the next world, what's called judgment, what that means. We try to explain it. And we've chosen it because it touches on these very deep subjects. Now, we got to the following point. What we were studying together last time was... You're encouraged, by the way, to see this from the beginning. If you knew or you weren't here from Elul when we began this, this has been well translated in a separate volume on its own. In fact, I think the first chapter alone constitutes one of the volumes. Right? They've translated this section with notes as well, so you can catch up these very, very essential and basic ideas and also give more meaning to the discussions that we're having. The last subject we noted was that there's a very strange and amazing description of how a spiritual accounting is made. We talk about it, as we pointed out last time, in childlike terms of a judgment and being put in some kind of a courtroom in the spiritual world, in the next world. There are advocates who speak for you, adversaries who speak against you, which are your own deeds, in fact. We tried to explain last time, without repeating the whole discussion, that is really a way of saying that you actually come face to face with yourself. Doesn't mean there's no courtroom that they speak about you in. You simply experience the totality of what it is that you're left with after a lifetime. And that happens all the time. It doesn't only happen at the end of a life. It happens in a unique way at the end of a person's life. But it happens all the time. The amazing thing is, and this is a subject we'll get to later in more detail, we didn't emphasize this aspect last week, is that while a person is judged all the time, and the consequences, it's a remarkable thing, there's no way we can understand it. That's an aspect of Emunah, we have to know this. The consequences of where you're holding spiritually become apparent all the time, even though we can't necessarily feel it. Let's try and explain that very briefly before we move on. We know that there's amazing contradiction, but if something's not clear, please ask questions. If I'm able to, I'll answer questions. Try and ask exactly on what's relevant, what we're discussing, issue immediately at hand if it's not clear, or you have something to ask or add. We have the most amazing paradox of the spiritual world. The whole spiritual world works on paradox. Not the paradox between the body and the spirit, the neshama. The whole idea of spirituality is one big paradox. We have to develop that idea again some other time. But one of the deepest paradoxes, aspects of this paradox, is the fact that everything is foretold or foreknown. Hashem knows beforehand what will be, and yet you're free to choose what you want to do. There's no way we can understand that. We can say a lot about it. We can understand a lot of things more than what we do now. And in Mitzvah Hashem, when we get to it, the Rambam discusses it in detail, we'll see in more depth. But one aspect of that paradox is that while a person's free, and they're given rein, they're given rope, right, with which to move and maneuver, and yet, despite that, every action calls into being a consequence which takes effect immediately. We can't understand how that could be and how we could not experience it. The way the Gemara puts it is that a person has in his body, it's a very amazing subject, a person has in his body what are called arvin. Arvin are, the English word would be, I don't really know an accurate English word, I think it's called guarantors, or somebody who stands surety. Collaterals, maybe. I don't know. The people who stand surety for whatever it is that you want to do. Which, but in a much deeper sense, it means in halacha you have a kind of person who stands surety where you make a loan, you borrow money, he guarantees to pay it back. But there's a deeper kind of an orev, a guarantor, whatever you call it, in halacha, which is an orev kablan. That means somebody who so undertakes your debt, that means to be the guarantor of your debt, that the person who lends you the money goes to him first, not to you. You follow? He undertakes your debt, underwrites it to say, do you have anything like that in business? I'm not too familiar with the business world. I don't know if you have that in secular business terms. But in halacha, you have such a thing. You have somebody who guarantees your loan. He stands surety for you, and if you can't pay, he'll pay back. But then you have somebody who undertakes your responsibility in a deeper sense. That when the person comes to claim his money, he doesn't even have to come to you. He can go straight to that person. You follow? So the deepest sense of being responsible for somebody else's, actually it says that that's how we're all responsible for each other. Action. Now, if you think you're getting away with something at somebody else's advantage, somebody else's cost, to your advantage, actually, you have undertaken as a Jew to be responsible for him to that extent. So you're actually going against that. I have to understand this also. That happened to us at Sinai. The point is that the Gemara says that we have such a concept that in your body you have one of these guarantors. That Hashem sends you out into the world with an agency that lives within you that guarantees everything that you do. That means that calls you to account according to his accounting. And those are your legs. Those are your legs. Very strange thing. The Gemara says that Ragloye debarinish, debarinchi, the legs of a person, inun arvinbei, they are the guarantors that are in him. Which means that your legs walk you in a direction, even though you think you're choosing, your legs walk you in a direction that actually you have to go in. Can't understand that, because actually you are choosing. I'll just give you one example. We did mention it here, I think maybe a year ago. I'll give you the example, just to try and get a feeling for how deep these things go. If you don't understand it, I don't blame you. We're not supposed to understand it. We can't really understand it, but we'll understand a lot more about what we can't understand later when we see the Rambam talk about it. So, right? Which means in one way your problems will get less, but in one way it'll get much worse. Right? But what can you do? No, you can't understand the whole... But nevertheless, you have to know about it. The Gemara says that an example of this phenomenon was an event that happened to King Shlomo, King Solomon. Now, the Gemara, we are taught it by him because he was the wisest of all men. If anybody knew how the whole spiritual system worked, it was he. And yet, this is what happened to him. The Gemara says that he had... one day Shlomo became aware that the Malach HaMavis, you know what that is, the angel of the one who ends a person's life, that Malach was visible to him. He perceived the Malach. He saw the Malach was going around very downcast. He perceived, whatever this means, you have to understand what this means. Anyway, he saw the Malach was going around very sad. So he said to him, listen, what's bothering you today? So the Malach said to him, you know, it's a strange thing. I've been sent to take two human beings. I've been sent to take the neshamas, right? To take out of the world two people. And I can't get a hold of them. I can't... I'm trying to get them and I can't get them. And he mentioned the names of who these people were. Very beautiful people, the Gemara says. They were friends of Shlomo's. They were his personal friends. He liked them very much. So immediately, he had them transported very far away. He had them transported to a certain town. I think it's a town called Lud, if I'm not mistaken. Luz or Lud, I think it's called Lud. He had them transported to a town called Lud. Why? How he did it is a whole mystical, magical thing. But he had them taken immediately, whisked away to this town called Lud. Why? Because it says in the mystical tradition that that's a town where death can never strike. No one can ever die there. Special thing that happened in that town. The Malach HaMavet has got no power in that place. If you want to be safe, you go there. So he took his friends, knowing that they were a target of the Malach HaMavet, and he had them deposited right outside the gates of that city, so that they'd be able to be, their lives would be saved. As they got there, they died. As they got there, they died. Right outside the gates, they both died. So the next day, he saw the Malach HaMavet was very happy. So he said to him, why are you so happy? So Malach HaMavet said, you know what happened to me yesterday? Amazing thing. I was sent to get two people, and the reason I couldn't get them is that my orders were that I was only allowed to take them outside the gates of Lud. And I couldn't get them there. There's no way I could get them there. And what happened? Suddenly I found them, and Shlomo suddenly realized that he had used his choice in the highest way possible to save two people's lives, and that had killed him. That's the way the world works. You make the choices. You make the choices, but the results, not necessary. We'll discuss this in more detail. If you're puzzled, I don't blame you. We'll have to discuss this. But you walk around with legs, that you take your legs where you want them to go, but your legs are sent by Hashem, actually work for Hashem. You think it's directing them where you need to go. Actually, they're his guarantors, and they're checking all the time that debts are being paid. Despite the fact that you get extensions and you can do tshuva and you don't have to pay immediately, but nevertheless, the guarantors walk with you. It's like people think the conventional wisdom is that when you walk through life, it's like walking. Many people say it's like walking through a big supermarket. You take things off the shelves and you enjoy yourself. But there's a checkout counter at the end. At the end, you've got to square up. You've got to make an accounting. When they charge you for everything you took. Right now, it's fantastic. It's like a big holiday, a big supermarket, a holiday resort. Plenty of things you can do over there. You can have fun. You can go on all the rides. There's all kinds of things. But they're keeping a check on you at a fantastic computer over there. And they check up your, they got your number. And when you check out, so you have to pay, you have to settle. That's why, as we've discussed many times, the philosophy of a Jew is to take as little as possible out of the world. Only to take out of the world those things that help you achieve what you're supposed to be doing over here. Because that you don't have to pay for. That you get free. That you get free. As we've said many times before, it's exactly as I've often tried to explain. It's the Chofetz Chaim and others. They say it's like a person being sent on a business trip with a big expense account. So the expense account is irrelevant. The company doesn't mind paying the expense account when the person brings home the deals. But if he spends a big expense account, it doesn't close the deals, so then he's going to have to pay back the money that he, for all the caviar on the nights at the Hilton, he's going to have to. That's what life is like. And therefore, if you're using anything in the physical world, no matter how pleasurable, no matter how opulent and how lavish, if you're using it for the right reason, you get it free. You get it free. Because if you use it for mitzvah activity, or for developing yourself in the correct way, you get it free. I'll give you an example. It says that every word you speak is measured. You have a finite number of words to say. Do you know that? When you're born, you're given a finite number of words. If you exceed that number of words, you've had it. You're only allowed a finite number of words. And that's why you should weigh every word critically. But it does not include words of Torah and mitzvah. If you speak many words to somebody that are words of kindness, or helping a person, or words of Torah, so then those words are free. But words that you speak for your own, right, your own sake, not when you go out for dinner with friends and you sit around for 3.5 hours talking about absolutely nothing. That's plenty of words about absolutely nothing. But those words you have to pay for. You don't get them free. But when you use them for the right reason, you get them free. That is the conventional idea. But actually it's deeper than that, which is what we're trying to explain. And that is that it's not that you pay at the end. Actually, while you are moving through the system, there's an accounting being made all the time. You don't always have to pay immediately. You do get extensions, which is what we discussed before, that you can do tshuva. But nevertheless, there's an accounting being made all the time. There are guarantors who are walking with you and making sure that everything works out. Not that you're free to do what you want until the end. It doesn't work that way. It's much more complicated. Now, in the terms of this balancing, which is what we began to discuss, we pointed out a fascinating thing, and the men have to know this. Any wise woman will take note of it also. And that is that if among the mitzvahs that a person omitted to do, or among the transgressions that a person did, there is one unique mitzvah that prejudices a person's chances in the next world in the most amazing way, and that's putting on tefillin. We mentioned that last time, you should remember it very carefully. The Rambam's view is that if a man never put on tefillin, then he has a tremendous, it's a thing that weighs against many, many, it's a very, very amazing, amazingly weighty transgression is not to have put on tefillin. The Rambam's opinion is at least once. You shouldn't put on tefillin once, you should put them on every day. In the days of the Gemara, they wore them all day. Right? They wore them all day. We're not capable of doing that. Because to wear tefillin, you have to have a perfectly clean body. Perfectly clean body. Not even a faintest suggestion of anything unclean about the body. That's why bar mitzvah boys are not allowed to wear tefillin until about a month before the bar mitzvah, because a young child can't keep himself scrupulously clean. You have to, and not only that, but your thoughts have to be, if you're wearing tefillin, you have to be thinking in Kedusha all the time. I once went to visit my Rebbe, unexpectedly, it was about 10 o'clock in the morning. I came into his house and I found him in shirt sleeves and he had his tefillin on. So I was with one or two other people and we said we wanted to speak to him about something. So he said to us, do you want to speak about something that's in Divrei Kedusha, something that has holiness attached to it, or not? If yes, I'll keep my tefillin on. If not, I'll take them off. So we said, no, it is, and we had the whole discussion while he said it. Some people still do that today. But you have to be confident that you can maintain yourself at a level of punctilious cleanliness and that your thoughts should never wander to anything other than so. That takes tremendous self-control, and that's why we don't wear our tefillin all day. It's bad enough, hard enough for us to put them on for half an hour in the morning or an hour and get it right. And so that's all we do. But there are people who do more than that. Anyone who knows of Scheinberg, anyone who's ever seen him, will notice that he has some unusual features about him. He wears his tefillin all day. He also wears about 36 pairs of tzitzis. This is not the kind of thing we want to mention tomorrow night for people having trouble with Yiddish guys. But he went through some experience in his life where he promised, he made some neder, I don't know what it was, that he took on to try and fulfill one mitzvah. At least that mitzvah should be fulfilled in all its perfection, and he wears every version possible. He's a small man and he looks like an American football, the shoulders like a small tzitzis. And his famous comment is, when people ask him for advice, he says, be normal. But it's, I'm going to tell you, when you have a mind of one of the greatest of the generation, so then you want to wear a tefillin all day, and you want to wear that many pairs of tzitzis, you can do that. I heard from, somebody heard from his wife, my wife told me, that he only eats food from a Siddur mitzvah. Isn't that remarkable? From a Siddur mitzvah, a meal that was the meal that went together with a mitzvah, like a wedding meal, or a bris, the meal served at a bris, or something like that. His wife keeps the fridge stocked with things that she takes from any Siddur mitzvah, and it only eats. You must go and meet such a person in order to have a feeling for what greatness can be. Now, that's with regard to wearing tefillin all day. So that's a thing that a person should never miss. The Rambam says at least once. That means at least once in your life a person should be very, very careful to put on a kosher pair of tefillin. Should borrow a pair of tefillin if you don't have, that are definitely kosher, from somebody who really knows. Speak to Rabbi Zaydan or somebody who knows what he's doing. Make sure you put on a valid kosher pair of tefillin at least once correctly. You should do it much more than that to make sure you covered it. A big tragedy to put on the tefillin and find later that they were old and the inside was cracked or damaged. That sort of person, at least once.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not a feminine. What's
the woman's equivalent of tefillin?
Yeah.
Did you hear the question at the back? She's not a feminist, yeah. Can I ask you, do you mind if I dodge the question? I'll tell you why, because to answer the question properly, you must have a whole session on that subject and do it properly, okay? There are much more difficult aspects of your question than you've raised. We make a blessing in the morning that says, women make a blessing saying, thank you Hashem for making me the way you made me, and men make a blessing saying, thanks for not making me a woman. We won't raise this tomorrow night either. These things have wonderful answers, and I think, I know you personally have been here long enough to have heard me say many things about the greatness of women, and anybody who's sensitive to what Judaism, Torah teaches about women will know that if anybody has a level of greatness and maturity and the capability of bringing the redemption, it's only women, and that men never rise to that level of adulthood, of maturity. We've discussed this many times before. So the feminist issue is not really an issue, but it really has to be discussed properly. So if you don't mind, I am avoiding the issue, but it has to, you know, I don't feel I can. If you want to know just one detail, you can put on tefillin and tzitzis also. A woman is allowed to put on just like a non-Jew. A woman. I'm not making comparison between a woman and a non-Jew. But they are both categories who are not commanded in certain mitzvahs. By the way, men are also not commanded in certain mitzvahs. Only kohanim are. And if you're a Levi, you're not. And if you're Israeli, everybody's got his own set. But women have a certain set of mitzvahs that they're not commanded in. Non-Jews have a set that they're not commanded in. And certain men have certain sets and stuff. Anybody who wants to fulfill a mitzvah that's not one that he's commanded and he's allowed to do it, and he gets the reward for the mitzvah. Only it's not an obligation. And Rashi's granddaughters wore tefillin. And it says, Michal wore tefillin. Right? I'm not... I'm not suggesting before you do it, you should. It's a complicated issue, but you certainly can everyone. The only exception is a non-Jew who wants to learn Torah or keep Shabbos. Definitely shouldn't do that. Those are the two exceptions, right? If says if even forfeits his right to live if he learns Torah or keeps Shabbos, with the exception of the Torah that's relevant to his mitzvah that he has to learn like a Jew. But mitzvahs that are not relevant to him, he shouldn't learn the Torah of those mitzvahs. So that's another discussion, not for now. But let's do it. You don't have an equivalent to that mitzvah. You have your own set, which a man could never do, and that's where your greatness is. Just like a Kohen has his set, and I could never do those. That's his greatness, mine is doing my job. And so forth and so on. A king has certain mitzvahs that he has to do. Certain Levim in the base of Mikdash had to guard the gates, and others had to sing, and if they did each other's job, they got killed for it. Everybody's got his own. And you've also been here, I believe, at a discussion we had about each person finding his own constellation of personality factors to work out exactly what it is. I'm supposed to give a talk about it, I think, on Tuesday night. I think I'm giving a talk about it on Tuesday night at Yeshiva College. I'm sure they don't object. No, I'm not. Won't I? I'm not giving a talk about it. I'm not doing. I believe I'm giving a, I am at Yeshiva College. I'm giving a talk on Tuesday night about the difficult job of cutting out in life what it is that you're supposed to be doing as opposed to everybody else, even though we all got mitzvahs that many that may be the same, but how do I know what it is that I was put here to do as opposed to what you were put here to do? And that's part of it. I would strongly recommend that if you're interested in the subject and you didn't come when we discussed it here, which we've done twice before at least, then you're very welcome to either get a recording or you could attend that share, and I'll do my best to try and explain what it means to have a unique function in the world. When it comes to a woman's function, as we've discussed many times before, that's exactly where greatness is. Only it's done privately. She doesn't have things that are seen public. But we'll have to blend that undertaking and I get back from it. So maybe we'll have a whole session again on, you know, really try and work out this whole subject of what it is, man and woman, and what how they function. So that's one exception and one special mitzvah. Now let's continue from there. But a person who doesn't put on tefillin, says the Rambam, despite this whole heavy negative thing that it engenders, nevertheless he has a share in the world to come. And we're now going to discuss what it means, a share in the world to come, to some extent. All wicked, evil, people whose negativity, they so put out negativity into the world that it overbalances the positivity, what they build, they're judged according to everything that they did wrong. But they have a share in the next world. You hear that? No matter how bad you are, says the Rambam, if you have an overbalance, an outstanding debit, that you have done more harm in the world to your own personality, to your relationships, to the whole cosmic structure, you've overall generated more damage. Right? You're not as clean as when you were born. You've done damage that builds up to a debit, never mind neutral, you've fallen below that, so then you have to pay for everything that you've done. How you pay, we'll discuss later. But you have a share in the next world. Every Jew has a share in the next world. Actually, every human being does also. But right now we're talking about Jews. We'll get into this in more detail. Now, why? Why do you have a share in the world to come, no matter how bad it is what you've done? And listen carefully, because in the next parak, the next paragraph, the Rambam is going to go into those who don't have a share in the next world. So let's understand carefully. Here he tells you that every Jew does have a share in the next world. Because it says, every Jew has a share in the next world, even though they sinned, because it says, your nation is entirely righteous, they are all righteous, they will always inherit the land. This land is a marshal. Doesn't mean the land, doesn't mean a person will inherit the land, it means the land, the real land, what's called the higher land, which means the land of Israel, if you like, in its spiritual depth, right, which is the higher, the next world. Kelema Eretz Achaim. That means the land of the living, or the land of life, which is called the next world. Now, in case you think we're prejudiced, V'chein Chasida Umas Oilam, the righteous people of the non-Jews, Yeshlem Chalek Lom Abba, they have a share in the next world. And I believe last week we mentioned a little bit about what a non-Jew has to do in order to claim his share in the next world, what a Jew has to do, what a non-Jew has to do. Now, let's see, right now before we see the next subject that he begins, which is connected, are there any questions on what he said immediately? Okay, he says like this, we are now going to discuss those people who forfeit their right to eternal existence. Now, the words in English are very, very misleading. Whatever you say in English, kills the subject. Okay, whatever you say in English is exactly the opposite of what we mean. But the Hebrew words are very, very specific. We'll try and explain it. Ve'elohein, these are those. She'ein lahen chelek l'olam haba. They have no share into that world. They have no share in that world. Ella, but rather, nichrasim ve'evdin, they are cut off from it. Ve'evdin, they are lost. Ve'nidonin al gedel risham, they are judged according to the greatness of the negativity that they brought in the world. Ve'chatosom, and the sins that they did. Le'olam ule'olmei olamim. Which is an amazing thing. I've never seen any other place in Torah that has used that word three times. Forever and ever and ever. Again, it doesn't mean ever and ever and ever. There's no word in English for what it means. It means for the world and for the world and for the world. We'll have to try and explain that. But loosely translated, it means they are cut off from spiritual existence forever and ever and ever. That's what it says. And now he's going to list who they are. Before we list who are those, and it's a very frightening subject, I suggest you don't come next time if you've got a weak heart, unless you're going to take it seriously. Because who doesn't have a share in the next world? It's not so simple. Right? It's not that difficult to be. It's possible, let's put it that way. Right? It's possible, just by the nature of your telephone conversations, as you'll see, to fit into that category. So we'll discuss the subject when you have time to steel yourself. But let's just get the concept first. First of all, what does it mean not to have a share in the world to come? Now, the Rambam says that these people are cut off. It's what you call spiritual excision. Right? Kores. Kores means karet. It means to cut off existence from the next world. Again, you have to understand, it doesn't mean the next world in the sense that it's a place a person goes where you experience. It's not that. It's you yourself. It means you cut yourself off from your own level of intrinsic existence, as we've tried to explain many times before. It's your own spirituality, it's your own inner being that is no longer housed inside the body. That has been killed, and you've damaged that to the extent that it can't breathe anymore. You haven't fed it, you've starved it of food and water that it needs on its level, and therefore just not alive anymore. Now, that has many, many consequences. You'll see that people in that situation, there are many symptoms. They desire things that are abnormal. They don't desire spirituality. They desire perversions. Why? Because as the Rambam explains elsewhere, when a person's sick, so then his whole appetite gets messed up. He wants things that are not good for him. And to get back to health, he has to eat things that actually don't taste good, until he develops the right taste. So a person's wires get crossed, and a lot of things start to go wrong when a person's in that situation. What does it mean technically? So the Gemara says that chorus means this. First of all, it means a person dies young, chas v'sholom. Gemara discusses what age is. Secondly, it means childlessness, chas v'sholom. And if a person has children already, it's very bad. What can happen? Those are the things that can happen for a person in this category. And it means that in the next world he doesn't exist. But not only doesn't exist in the next world, he experiences the fact that he doesn't exist. So it would be fine if he just didn't exist over there. But it's not like that. It's the awareness of not being what he should be. It's like a person, can you imagine the experience of trying, of being in the world where nobody can see you and you can't express yourself at all and your body just isn't there. And as you try and do things, there's no body with which to do it. It's much worse than that. Much worse. Because it's the pain of having lost all those parts of the body as they get sort of torn away or diseased or whatever it is. Something like that. And that is just, as they say in the classics, she ain't seen nothing. Because what we've begun to describe here, you have to put a bit of humour into the subject, otherwise because what we've there are descriptions of the suffering that a person endures in the next world which are too horrific to mention. I don't feel able to mention some of them here, partly also because they have to be understood correctly. They sound like a very sort of medieval fundamentalist kind of pictures of things. We have to understand what they mean in abstraction, but nevertheless, that's what they amount to. Now, let's try and understand. So, we have here, the first thing to understand is, we have a contradiction. Right now, the Rambam says that there are categories of people, we're going to list 13 categories of people, each with many subsections, that could lose a share in the world to come. And yet, we just said above that everybody has a share in the world to come. Yep, we have a problem. So, let's hear over here the good news and the bad news, exactly what it means. The first thing is this, the good news is this, that no matter how bad a person is, as he said above, they have a share in the next world. The only thing is that there are different levels or qualities of what it means to exist in the next world. At the first level, we mentioned this before, when it says you have a share in the world to come, every Jewish neshama has a share in the world to come, a chelek, chelek means you have your own portion cut out for you. It means your own inheritance that you actually own, it's yours. Actually, it's not yours, it's you. But nevertheless, you own it in totality and you have the experience of the fact that you created it. That's what it is. But there is a possibility of existing in that world in such a way that you don't own it. You're just there, but you're there only by virtue of the fact that you belong to the Jewish people. And I'm not going into non-Jews here. It's also true. We're just focusing on the Jews right now. By virtue of the fact that you belong to the Jewish people. So you're there, you follow, because your parents built up such credit that they just didn't feel they could exclude you. Yeah, it's like you have that many times. You arrive at an exclusive country club or some other place like that, and it just so happens that you are not the kind of material that they wish to have over there. But it so happens that your parents were honored members of that club for many years. They were founding members of the club, and therefore they just can't exclude you. We come from a stock, from a line that have built up such credit and have done so much for Hashem and have been through such torture for Him. That's so unflinchingly been through such brutal torture for so many centuries that they just can't exclude us. You at least have to make the effort to connect yourself up to those people who went through that for you. The Rambam is going to say that one of the categories of people who don't deserve it are those who divorce themselves from that line. You have to at least, if you walk into the country club and you say, no, they're not my parents, we're not going to let you in. You follow? If you walk into this exclusive country club in your tattered shorts and you're, you know, without the tie that's required over there, the jacket and tie, and you drop your name, and the whole club is named after your family, they're not giving you a chance example exactly how it is. So what happens is they bring you in your tattered shorts and your... And they find you a tie quickly and a jacket. But if you arrive at the door and you sing, drop your name, and then when they say, of course, come in, and then you say, no, I'm not related to that. You know, that's not my side of the family. So then they close the door on your face. You have to at least connect yourself up. And there are other requirements, as we'll see. But nevertheless, you have an existence. Not a share, but an existence. You don't have your own share, you have your parents' share. You have the share that's generated by the great people that led the way that we are descended from. And therefore, my Rebbe once put it, I think I mentioned it to you, he said that instead of having your own transport, you'll have to use public transport. That's what it is. In other words, you'll be there, but you'll be there on the schus of Kol Yisrael. It means you'll have public transport, you'll live, you'll eat at other people's tables. You'll be there, but you won't have your own peace because you didn't build your own peace, but you'll be there. Now, there's another piece of news that's better than that, and that is that ultimately a person will get exactly where he's supposed to go. Now, this is only stated in the Kabbalistic tradition, which the Rambam is not dealing with here, and that is that a person will eventually get exactly where they're supposed to be. Not only that, but every blade of grass, every grain of dust, every single part of the creation eventually will sing the song that it was created to sing. Exactly. Because Hashem, when He puts something into operation, He's going to make a success. Every detail is going to be successful. The only thing is, you have a choice of how to get there, that's all. Free choice just means that you can build yourself into a situation where you merit that existence through your own effort. Or you can get there the bad way, the difficult way. I once had a Sephardi Rebbe who said that an analogy for this, just an analogy, would be that when Adam sinned, so what happened? He had a job to do, and he could have got there the easy way, but he chose to get there the hard way. What's the easy way? He had to do what he had to do for a few hours, and he would have reached Shabbos. The hard way, he failed, and he split into millions of people, us, and each of us has to do a little bit of the job, the hard way, and all of us together eventually have to... Rebbe said that it's like a man who was told to carry a bucket of sand from one place to another, and instead of carrying the sand on the way, he spilt all the sand. So now what they did, they took away the bucket, and he had to carry it now in little handfuls. That's the hard way. Scraping up the handfuls and the grains of sand, but he's going to get the sand. It's going to take a lot longer. Instead of a few hours, it's taking 6,000 years. And instead of just the difficulty of having to resist one temptation, we have to go the torture and brutality of 6,000 years of anti-Jewish butchery. But we're going to get the job done. And similarly, in the next world, each neshama will get the job done, will get to where he has to get. Only you'll have free choice whether you do it the easy way, by suffering here, to some extent. Actually, it's not a suffering when you live that way of life. It's the most beautiful way of life it could be, but nevertheless, using some self-control, working on yourself, and then you experience that directly, or you don't do it here, you have to do it there. One way or the other, but eventually you go. Which means that when the Rambam says that there are souls that are cut off from the next world forever and ever and ever, in Hebrew there's no word for forever. In Hebrew the word is le'olam. Le'olam means for the world, which means that as long as the world exists, there's a concept that certain neshamas will have to go into some situation of suffering for a certain amount of time. Don't ask me what time means in that world, but something that corresponds to time. The longest a person could ever go there is the longest time that exists, which means until the world finally goes back to its original, or its final form of perfection, then those neshamas will be there also. Other neshamas will get out of that situation much earlier on their own merits. But these who lose all their right will get there only by the passive, what you call the default program, right? Only because there's no other way to go at the end. But everybody will get there in the end. The reason it's only mentioned in the Kabbalistic tradition is because it's not recommended. It's not recommended going that way. Even though you can get there that way. And actually, ultimately, we can't understand what the difference will be, since you'll be a part of Hashem in the end, and there will only be that perfection. So who cares which way you go? But it's not recommended, because Hashem himself says, although you can get there the hard way, and I will get you there the hard way, I ask you to do it the easy way. Choose life and don't choose death. So we ultimately do it because he asks us. Most of us do it because we're too darn afraid to do it the other way. Because we're just afraid, right? That's called tshuva meyira. That's not called doing what Hashem wants out of love for him. That's called doing what Hashem wants out of fear for him, and it's a valid motivation. Most people never get beyond that. But ultimately, if you want to reach the highest level, it's because out of love for him, he asks you to do it the nice way, the easy way, the way that's an expression of love, and not the way that's an expression of discipline. Just like a parent would love his child to do the things that he wants and become what the parent wants the child to become through the way of earning reward and praise all the time, then they have to be bashed and battered into being that. Why does a parent want that? Why does a parent want that? Only the neshama can tell you that. There's no answer for that. Why would a parent... is that right? If a parent has the thrill of seeing a child become in the end what they wanted the child to become, which is very hard, by the way. Very, very hard. You need a lot of tears and a lot of tehillim that a child should be the best family, that a child should turn out, that the way should turn out. It's not a simple thing. But if a child does turn out the way you want in the end, what's the difference if you did it by strict discipline all the way or by loving approbation all the way? What's the difference in the end? He turned out fine in the end. There's a big difference. And a parent's heart feels which way he wants it. And that's what Hashem wants us to do, is to get there that way and not the other way. But I have to tell you that in the Kabbalistic tradition, it does say that either way, a person will get to the same thing. But that's at the end. And it's not the recommended pathway. The recommended pathway is the one that involves earning it on your own steam and not being battered into it. Are there questions on this section? What you should be thinking of, what we should be thinking of here, is the fact that this means, we don't often enough, I think, emphasize these things. That is that these things imply the most enormous level of obligation. You come to Shirim for many months and be entertained. I'm not being personal. You're welcome to come to Shirim. I'm not offended if you don't. I mean, I'm happy to have you. If you don't come, I'll learn on my own. But when we learn together, so it's supposed to bring us to a level where we do something different about ourselves. Torah learning in itself is a mitzvah. Sure, you did a mitzvah. You acquired that mitzvah simply by coming and learning. But unfortunately, if it doesn't get put into action, into practice, so then there's a strange and very cruel seeming twist to Torah learning, is that you don't even get the benefit of the learning. Kol she'eino b'lemida, eino b'asiya, eino b'lemida. Somebody who's not holding in the concept of acting out and practicing what he learns, so then it's not considered learning either. Right? Somebody reads the manual for a machine and never gets to work the machine, so what's worth reading the manual? In fact, there's got to be something wrong with the person. He spends a lot of effort in studying the manual till he gets all the details right, becomes an expert at the thing, he never switches it on. He needs his head read, that kind of person. Somebody who comes to get involved with Torah and knows about it all and never goes and activates any of it, so not only is he not activating anything in his personality, but it's counted as if he never learned. Because Torah only applies when it's put out into the world. If you want to know, that's what a woman does. What a woman does is responsible for taking that which is theoretical in the world and actually making it alive, which is what she needs to teach man, because a man is generally not good at that. That's what a man has to learn, is not just to be entertained and stimulated by what he learns and understands, but actually go out and do it. And tomorrow night in Mitzvah Shem we'll try to talk about what a person should choose to do and how you start. But a person has to aim to grow. What can I tell you? Alright, let's see the next point. Another 5 minutes, right? Okay. You have a question? These are those who have no share in the next world. Okay? We're now going to hear some very heavy things. These are the categories of people who have no share in the next world. Says this. First of all, now I'm going to read you a list, okay? The list is not going to be clear until the Rambam himself goes through the list again and defines all the terms. So I'm going to go through the list for you. There are 13 things, I believe, in this list. I'm going to give you a rough translation, but make no fixed idea yet in your mind, because they're not what the English word suggests, not at all. And the Rambam himself will go through the subcategories and definitions of this list, and then we'll get a deeper understanding. But the list, as he states it, is as follows. First of all, Haminim. Minim means, again, I don't know how to translate it. In English, you'll see translated as deniers, or those who belittle the spiritual existence of spirituality, or those who are, I don't know, maybe atheists. We'll have to see more clearly, but people called Minim. It's hard to translate because the Hebrew word min means a species. Min means a type. Very interesting. As opposed to being a unique individual, which is what we hope to speak about on Tuesday, a min means a type or a species. Why people who deny, or people who live a purely physical existence, are described as being what's called a min, meaning somebody who's just a one of a species, we'll have to understand as well. But that's what it is. But for the meantime, you can hold in your head atheists or deniers or something, I don't know. Secondly, apikorsin. Again, it's very hard to distinguish between these two until we see the Rambam's explanation. Apikorsin, I'm sure the word itself means to most people more than any translation. Apikorsin, a denier, an atheist, Epicurean, I don't, we'll have to see. Hakeifrim b'teira, those who deny the validity of Torah. But they might accept the existence of a spirituality. They might go to seances and be big spiritualists and know all about the spiritual world and a transcendent existence and Hashem's existence and so forth, but they deny what Torah is. No share in the next world. Hakeifrim b'tchias ha-meisim, those who deny the concept of the resurrection of the dead, that's not the next world. That is those who deny the fact that the body will again be resurrected in a human form after it's died. That's a remarkable thing. You begin to hear over here the concept that if you deny the existence of the thing, well, then you don't have it. Because you only build the thing to the extent that you build it in your own neshama. These things aren't automatic. Okay? These things are built, as we discussed 2 weeks ago, I believe it was, the concept of judgment. The only way you judge is in terms of a mechanism that you set up yourself. And if you never set up the mechanism of judgment, like we explained 2 weeks ago, if you never accuse anyone else in any way, you'll never be accused in the next world. Because you never set up the mechanism. Similarly, on the other side, if you never set up the mechanism, if you never generate in your neshama a sensitivity and an awareness, right, a knowledge, not just you have to go around bamboozled into thinking. You don't have to do that. You have to know it, that there is a deeper meaning and a transcendent other existence. If you don't have that, how can you expect to experience it? You follow me? Imagine a person who walks around all the time denying that there's such a thing as love. And he refuses to let himself ever feel it. And he blocks off every opportunity. You're going to love anybody. Not only is it impossible that will happen, but in terms, it's a contradiction. You follow me? It can't be. So if a person doesn't build that reality for himself, but again, build it real, doesn't mean build it by walking around saying, yes, I believe. That doesn't do anything. Bamboozling yourself or being hypnotized or brainwashed into it is irrelevant. That won't help at all. A person has to get to know that with certainty. How you do that, we have to discuss also, and it can take a lifetime, but a person has to know about these things. That's at least be open to it. At least accept the fact that it may be a possibility, at least that, but to deny it outright and to be categorically clear that it can't exist, even though you can never know that. So you can never experience it then. Are you with me? It's not just a punishment, it's something you build yourself. We'll have to see this in more detail. So that's amazing. Ubabir Sagoel, those who deny the coming of a human Mashiach, that there will be a messianic revelation that we'll experience. These people not only won't share that experience, they're not talking about that, but an existence in the next world they don't have. Hamoedim, those who rebel, we'll have to see what that means exactly, against what and how are they rebelling. Umachtiyei Harabim, a very, very, very painful one in this generation, those who lead the public astray, those who cause the masses of the Jewish people to sin, right? Which means that if you have Jews who belong to, let's call it, certain branches, if you want, of Judaism. They're not branches of Judaism. They've got nothing to do with Judaism. But I don't know what to call them. Call them sects or cults or... I don't know. But they call themselves Jewish anyway. Okay? We won't reform our tradition. Held liable. The Rambam doesn't include them. If they were brought up that way, or they were taught that, or they come to accept the thing without knowing any better, how could you expect a person to know? But those who lead them, those who should know, those who have access to information, those who have experienced it and know it, and they lead people into a system where they downright definitely not fulfilling Torah mitzvahs and often going against it for whatever reason, so they have no share in the world to come. It says it openly over here. But we'll discuss this in detail also. I'm sure you want to ask a lot of questions, exactly whom and how and where. We'll discuss. Hapoishin midarkei tzibur, listen to this, a person who divorces himself from the ways of the Jewish public, listen carefully, somebody who divorces himself from the Jewish community, it does not say in the Rambam that we are referring to someone who divorces himself from the Jewish community in so far as he doesn't do mitzvahs or do what a Jew is supposed to do. We're not saying that. This could be a person who keeps mitzvahs. You hear? This could be a person who keeps mitzvahs. He could learn, he could keep mitzvahs, he could do it, but he doesn't associate himself with, it's hard to imagine how you'd have such a thing. But what I'm getting at is it might be a moral individual. It might be a person who's really moral. He has a whole code of values and he's working on himself. It could be all those things. But he doesn't connect himself with the reality of the organic unity, the body, that is the existence of the next world. He won't ever share the next. You follow? The Rambam has already singled out those who don't keep mitzvahs, which mitzvahs it is and how bad they have to be. Here he's talking about somebody who doesn't have those problems. He might believe in Tchias HaMaisim. He might believe in the Torah, and he doesn't mistrust Hashem and so forth and so on. But he doesn't hold his part of the Jewish community. The Rambam will explain later what it means. He doesn't fast when we fast. He doesn't rejoice when we rejoice. He comes into the Jewish and he doesn't like the Jewish community. He hangs out on his own. That kind of individual doesn't have a share in the next world. Let's understand why that's so serious. Let's understand all these things. Ha'oise averis b'yad rama, yad ramo, somebody who transgresses Torah laws, Torah mitzvahs, b'yad ramo, that means literally with a high hand. In English you have the same expression, high-handedly. It means blatantly, publicly maybe, blatantly, okay? In other words, it's not the fact that he transgresses Torah laws that keeps him out of an existence in the next world. It's simply the fact that he does it in a way that shows that he feels nothing for it. And it doesn't even have to be major. The Rambam doesn't say that he has to go around killing people or stealing in a major. The Rambam says he does Averis. Averis, it could be that he eats bread on Pesach. It could be, that is a heavy thing. Right? But it could be any, the Rambam doesn't say which Averis, but he does it high-handedly. Right? He goes to, I hate to give you this example, what can I do? It's well known that they're members of the Israeli government. What can I tell you? In the early days of the state, when hosted at the White House, there were, I don't want to tell you the name because you, but anyway, when hosted at the White House by the American president, we were hosted at a banquet where there was a special kosher table. The president of Israel, prime minister of Israel, went over to the non-kosher table to show, to make a point, whatever reason. That is called high-handed disgrace to Jewish people. And it's not here, this is not an anti-Zionist speech over here. I happen to believe you should live in Israel. But nevertheless, high-handedly flouting and flagrantly denying what a Jew should be doing. It happened many times, unfortunately. In Israel, one of the main ironies of this whole situation is that when the Jewish state got going, so it started behaving in this fashion. What can I tell you? It's a very sad thing. When girls were drafted into the Israeli army. I've mentioned to you before, there are many Rishonim who hold that it's an Issur D'oraisa. For a woman to be in the army, there are many Rishonim who hold that it's a Torah transgression. There are many Rishonim who hold that for a woman to carry a weapon. For a woman to carry a weapon is a Torah transgression of wearing a man's apparel. I'm not talking about where it's important to save a life or for self-defense. Definitely it's allowed in that case. I'm talking about to be put into a military situation, apart from many other problems. So what happened is the whole labor bloc that introduced the law voted for it. There was only one member of the Knesset who voted against it. You know who it was? The Arab member of parliament. Why? Because he got up and he apologetically explained, and Ben-Gurion in his book, by the way, quotes the whole speech of this Arab. He got up and explained that he's very sorry to have to vote against his party, but it's against Muslim law. It's against Arab law. And he has a whole speech about what a woman is and where she should be and what her place is in the world. A whole very firm speech over there, this Arab. And he unfortunately couldn't vote with the party. Amazing. But all the Jews did. Anyway. That Aisha Averis Biyad Rama with a brazen chutzpah doing in public. Befarhesia, in public. Kayahoyakim, and he gives an example of somebody who behaved that way. Hamoisrim, next category. We'll just mention the categories and we'll leave it there for this evening. Moisrim are people who hand Jews over to the authorities. A Moiser is somebody who hands another Jew over to the non-Jewish authorities. Whether it will harm him physically, right? They'll either charge him with a capital offense, or whether it will harm him financially. Rambam will explain. That's called the Moiser. Somebody you don't like, so you report him. There are many, many prohibitions. We'll have to discuss this. It's very difficult. You have to know. It's forbidden for a Jew to go to a non-Jewish court in the first place. I don't know if you're aware of that. It's forbidden for a Jew to settle a difference with somebody in a non-Jewish court. What's a non-Jewish court got to do with the system of justice that we have? It's valid for them, and it's a mitzvah for them, as we've seen one of the seven mitzvahs. Nothing wrong with a non-Jewish court. Don't misunderstand me. You have to hear carefully. Not only is nothing wrong with a non-Jewish court, it's a mitzvah of the Torah that they should have courts like that. But a Jew is not allowed to go there. A Jew has to go to a Beis Din. What happens if a goy takes you to court? That's another story. You have to ask a shayla and work out whether you can go, whether you can't go. But a Jew to take another Jew to a non-Jewish court, first of all, it's invalid for the Jews, and second, a terrible disgrace that a goy has to sit in judgment. Again, listen carefully, we're not running down goyim. That a goy should sit in judgment over goyim is a big mitzvah, and he's going to get olam haba for that if he does it correctly. But that he should apply his system to us, two Jews who are bound by Torah, have to go stand in front of him, and he's got a paskin. Which of us is, you follow, you wouldn't take your chicken to him to ask if it's kosher or not. So why have to... So therefore, you're not allowed to go to a non-Jewish court. What happens if a non-observant Jew takes you to court? And that non-observant Jew will not hear the idea of being heard, the case in the Beis Din. A non-observant Jew usually will not agree to go to Beis Din with you. First of all, because he doesn't understand the whole system of Beis Din and what it means. And secondly, he very strongly feels he'll be prejudiced. The Beis Din will be prejudiced against him because it's your place. You understand what it means, and he won't have a fair hearing over there, which one could understand. So there, what to do when a non-observant Jew wants to take you to a secular court, it also has to be discussed in halacha. But there are many, many problems with going to non-Jewish authority. But here we're dealing with somebody who hands another Jew over to non-Jewish authority, okay? Unfortunately, happened a number of times in Jewish history, and not recently also. That a person is not allowed to do. And he could lose his share in the next world. And actually, he has a punishment on him that actually is much more severe than that. Not only does he lose his share in the next world, but even worse. We'll see later in the Rambam. Next, umatilei eima al hatzibur shelo l'shem shemayim, those who terrify the Jewish public when it's not for the sake of Hashem, those who use power, those who are in positions of leadership or have the ability, and they terrorize or they frighten the Jewish community where it's not for the sake of Hashem. If somebody gets up and gives a shmooze and terrifies you out of your wits about keeping mitzvahs or explains to you how important, that's allowed. That's the Shem Shemayim. He wants to make you do tshuva. He wants to give a drosha, a shmooze that will uplift the person, and even if it frightens you, but it brings you to Yerushalayim, you say, that's fine. But a person who terrorizes not for a higher purpose loses his share in the next world. V'sheifchei damim, those who spill blood, killing. Here comes a hard one. Okay, you better hold on to your chair for this. Baalei loshon hara. Okay? Those who... I wouldn't laugh if I were you. Baalei loshon hara, what? On loshon hara. Okay, Lina, they will do that still. Let's make a list of these kids. Baalei loshon hara, people who speak loshon hara. Just let's be careful about this. We'll have to go ahead and grab. Maybe, you know what, when we get to this, this is the 12th of the 13th. So, Blinere, when we get here to the concept of loshon hara and how it works, so then in Yitzhak Hashem we'll try and explain the concept fully. But I just wish you to note one thing over here. It says Baal Loshon Hara. It does not say people who speak Loshon Hara. A Baal Loshon Hara is somebody whose personality is Loshon Hara. Baal means an owner of or a husband of. It means, you follow me, it means somebody who, his lifestyle is that. This does not mean the person who occasionally happened to say something, otherwise none of us would be, none of us would have any share in the next world to speak of. This means somebody whose nature, what he does for fun, where he gets his life energy out of, okay, is what he or she happens to divulge over the telephone or in any other place. We'll have to discuss exactly how this works. Loshon Hara is a very, very detailed subject. We'll have to see it in detail. Even raising an eyebrow can be Loshon Hara. It doesn't have to be what you say. It can be a smirk or a sneer. It can be a non-reaction. It can be all kind of things. It can be ambiguous statements. It can be done in writing. Loshon Hara is one of the most frequently trampled on mitzvahs, and it is potentially one of the most serious. Let me just finish this and I'll take it. And therefore, if a person should be careful about one thing, it's that. In many ways, it's worse than the others, and we'll try and explain why. But again, it means a baal loshon hara. If you happen to say something negative about somebody once, that's an awful and most terrible and awesome thing, but it doesn't necessarily lose you a share in the world to come. What does lose a person a share in the world to come is someone who is habituated to speak loshon hara. That's a baal loshon hara. We'll have to explain that in more detail. Yes. We were asked that last week, and it has to be dealt with differently than speaking about a Jew. You must ask me privately, okay? Yeah. We're going to speak about that here also. The Rambam will deal with it. It's very there's worse news to come, okay? And that is that in the next chapter, the Rambam starts like this. There are 24 things that you can't do tshuva for. Now, don't panic. The introduction is that you can do tshuva for everything. But there are 24 things that are very difficult. Some things are difficult because you can't capture the damage to undo it. If you stole from somebody and you know how much you owe him, you can go back and pay back the money. In addition, you can ask him to forgive you and it's absolutely wiped out. But if you spoke about somebody to somebody else and they then spread that around and they formed a negative opinion because of that, this, by the time you try and undo it, so the ripples have gone out in such a way that it may be very, very difficult to undo. Later, but nothing's not amenable to tshuva. Later he will explain how you try and do tshuva for those things. And finally, let me remind you that if you did a thing that you didn't know anything about, if you're brought up in such a way that you really did what everybody else does and what's normal, so although the damage is done, but they only hold against you things that you, again, it all works. There's nothing unjust that's done in the spiritual world. If a person never knew about a thing, you follow, they can't, you can't, and didn't have to know about it. If you should have known about it, so then you're responsible to that extent. But it all works 100% fairly according to what you could have and should have known. You follow me? And therefore, a person must undo to the best of their ability whatever it was that they did. There are certain very lucky breaks you get in life that can wipe out all sorts of things. Yom Kippur, for example, has a special gift. The day you get married, the day that a chassan and kala get married, it's like a Yom Kippur for them, and it's absolutely a new start in life also. And there's certain other occasions also that you can utilize. There are a lot of tricks you can do, and you have to get slick at knowing these tricks. Yeah, somebody. Yes, please. Yes, you can do tshuva on everything. On these 13 things. Absolutely. The 24 categories that are listed later as things that you can't do tshuva for don't necessarily mesh with these. We have to study Machdes Arabim. That will fall later. You'll see it's difficult to undo because anything that you've done that ripples out beyond your control, it's very hard to go and undo the damage. But yes, you can do tshuva for everything. Absolutely, you can do tshuva for everything. Sometimes it takes an extreme action. I know personally of a certain rabbi who was a rabbi in a version, a branch of Judaism, who decided that it wasn't the right way to be and had the knowledge and became a Orthodox rabbi. But the way he did it was he announced it publicly, and he publicly and over made statements to make sure, do you follow, that people that would definitely go out into the world that what he'd done was wrong and he shouldn't live that way and anything he ever taught in that sense. You follow, he was trying to do tshuva by trying to recapture in the same way that he put it out, and that could be an amazing thing because it could be such an impressive thing that it could actually overshadow even the person that admits that he was wrong and that he puts this thing out. It's a complicated, computerized system. Does it get to every individual that the other things got to? It's complicated. We'll have to discuss that later. Yes, I think somebody else had a question. Okay, and finally, yeah. Yes. Yes, tshuva, you must know this. The first question is, can you do tshuva for these things? The general answer is yes, how we'll have to discuss. But if you do tshuva for anything, it's absolutely clean slate. Never mind your share in the world to come. The definition of tshuva is, it's as if you never did that thing, and in many cases, if you do tshuva correctly, that you are better than you were before you did it wrong. So absolutely, yes, definitely. I remember when I started getting involved, personally I can tell you, I grew up, I'm not about to divulge any, but I grew up, you know, in normal Johannesburg terms. I mean, I knew a lot, and I had a warm traditional upbringing and so forth, but there were many things I didn't know. And one of the things that terrified me most was certain areas that we haven't discussed exactly, but they are very problematic areas. And I went to my Rosh Hashiva, and he laughed at me. He said, it's all in proportion to what you understood and what you knew. You don't have to. You still have to do tshuva, but it's, you follow. It's according to, yes, please. Yeah, we did try and discuss this on a number of occasions. Very briefly, did you all hear the question? The question is, can you be affected in the next world by children and grandchildren? And the answer is like this, it's a lengthy answer, but in general, the answer is yes, that no matter how bad a person was, or how good they were, it makes no difference, whatever a person's essence is in the next world, everything that they left behind in the world, as it happens in the world, accrues to their credit. If you taught a child a certain thing, every time the child does that thing, it accrues to your credit because you put that into the world, to the extent to which you taught the child. If it's bad,
then it brings him down in the next world, if it's a consequence of his action. If the child chooses it out of his own free will, then it doesn't accrue to your credit or debit. But if a person puts something, even an inspiration, they were a special inspiring type of individual, even though they may have denied certain things, and the child was inspired by that, or even a friend. In fact, the truth is that every ripple of everything you ever did in your life ripples out into the world and has an effect. The effect that happens in the world is it's on your cheshbon, it's on your accounting. And therefore, in the next world where you can't make any changes anymore, but the changes are still coming home. The changes that you set out in the world, that you did in the world, are now all... And that's why we do so many things for parents who are no longer alive. What's called the Ilui Nishmas, whoever... You give books to your yeshiva, you give money to people in learning. Any mitzvah you do, you dedicate to that person. I'm not sentimental. What it means is, I'm doing this because I, especially a child... The reason it works most with a child is because it's not just a mitzvah. The child's only in the world because the person put him there. So everything he does can be traced back to the fact that that person put him in the world. Especially if that person put some effort, as most Jewish parents, even in the most non-observant context, up to this generation, put a tremendous amount of heartbreaking effort into their children, even though they might not have known the Torah way to do it, but they put, it's changing unfortunately now. Now we're going through a shattered generation. We'll talk about it tomorrow night. Now we're going through young parents who are almost able to give nothing. They themselves are shattered in many ways. It's a whole major tragedy. But until now, it hasn't been okay. And therefore, yes, you can change in the next world. And it says that there's a statement somewhere that parents in the next world will make a brocha on the children who disobeyed them. That means that a parent went denying and they were negative about the whole thing, and a child is observant in the world. The parent up there makes a brocha that the child didn't listen to them. You follow? Because now the whole school is that child. Over. And finally, yes, please.
What happens
if you give somebody else, but then somebody else keeps reminding you of
the bad thing that you did? It doesn't matter. I don't understand.
Yes. There's no problem with that. Let's just understand. Do you hear the question? You did something wrong to somebody, or at least they think you did something wrong, or maybe you actually did something wrong, and now you've tried to wipe it out, you apologize, you do the whole thing, and now they keep reminding you, right, of what you did. So now, the answer to that, I understand you're getting at something deeper over here also, but the technical side of what you're asking is this. If you do tshuva correctly, let's say you really did something wrong. Now you managed to do tshuva correctly. You have done the three steps of tshuva like we said, and you've got their forgiveness if it involves somebody else. And they said that they forgive you at the time. They forgave you. You now have fulfilled the mitzvah of tshuva, and it's a completely clean slate. The fact that they keep reminding you is completely irrelevant. It doesn't bring back that avera. The fact that they remind you, on the contrary, the more painful it is, the greater your merit. Doesn't bring back the avera. Unless what happens is every time they mention it to you, you do the same thing again. Because they drive you crazy and you do the same thing. You get into the same argument. You hurt them again. That's a different story. You've got a new avera to do tshuva for. You follow me? They might be making it hard. But the fact that they remind you that you did something before? Definitely not. Unfortunately, it's a sin to remind somebody of something they ever did wrong. It's a sin to remind somebody of what he was like or what his parents were, if it wasn't good. You should not allow to do that. The Ram will talk about it also. They shouldn't do that to you. But if they don't know that, so you must take it with the love that you can generate for it, and if you have to, and you... What can you do? You mustn't get back into the same situation and saying, but look, that's all over. Because they'll say, no, it's not over. You did it. No, doesn't matter. It doesn't affect the tumor. And finally, it says here, the 13th one, Hamoysheikh or Losoi. Somebody who... Again, this halachic concept, we'll have to deal with it more in detail. Somebody tries to undo his circumcision. Moshech Allah, so he tries to undo the fact that he's circumcised. Okay? Surgically, let's say. Certainly surgically. If a person would try to... It says that was the sin that Adam did. The sin of Adam Arishan was that he... That was one of the things that he did wrong on that Friday of creation. But it's to try to undo the fact that a person is circumcised. There is a statement in the Kabbalistic writing. I'll just leave you with a... Why should I make you happy? I'll leave you with a terrifying thought. As I've mentioned it before, it does say in the Kabbalistic writings that when a person is about to enter the dimension of pain, that means in the next world, he now has to go through a dimension of suffering to pay for the things that he did, as we discussed. It says at the entrance to that, place or that dimension sits a man, Abraham Avinu. Abraham sits at the entrance to that particular place. And as a Jew comes in, Avram Avinu is able to save him. He's able to pull him out. You follow me? As a Jew is about to enter into that situation of tremendous suffering, Avram Avinu pulls him out and saves him. What it means, again, not to understand it in childlike, childish terms, it doesn't mean that there's a man. What it means is that the schus, the fact that you are a member of that family, do you follow? The merit, his merit stands by you. Like I said before, if your name is the same name as the founder of the club, so then what happens is they don't make you pay the same dues as everybody or whatever, they give you special privileges. Why? You didn't do anything. Yeah, but they owe their existence to you. The spiritual world owes its existence to Abraham, in a very real sense. And therefore, if you happen to have the merit to be descended from him, Hashem wouldn't hurt him by punishing you. You follow that? He reached that merit that Hashem wouldn't hurt him. He doesn't deserve it that you should suffer, even though you deserve it. But he would suffer, so Hashem doesn't do it to him. That's what it means. He recognizes you. That's what it means. But there are two people that he can't recognize. There are two people he can't recognize. One is a Jew, uncircumcised, because he can't recognize him. The whole thing he brought to the world was that covenant with Hashem. And if you've taken away that sign, and it can't be recognized in you, you've undone that reality. You're not part of the family anymore. So he can't pull you out. Again, it's only people who do it deliberately and knowingly and so forth and so on. It's not a child who wasn't circumcised because he had a bleeding disorder where the halakha forbids it. He doesn't have to be circumcised. Or a child who was born circumcised. We're talking about somebody who deliberately tries to take himself out of that club. Okay? And secondly, somebody who had intimate physical relationship with a non-Jewish woman. A man who had an intimate relationship, not married to, had an intimate physical relationship with a non-Jewish woman, so that Avraham Avinu can't pull you out. Again, it depends on a person knowing a certain amount about these things and not having done tshuva for it. Okay, you have to know. But that is one of the categories. Again, before you panic, it has to be understood that it's with a full degree of responsibility that the Torah puts on such a person. A non-Jewish woman, it doesn't say the same, is also in the same category of prohibition. It doesn't say that she has a problem of being recognized when she's about to enter Gehenna, but you shouldn't think that it's any different, the prohibition or the punishment. Next Sunday night, I said a Jewish woman and a non-Jewish man is exactly the same. It doesn't come into the problem with a Jewish man is that he has gone against the bris. That's the problem. The problem is that he's taken something that's supposed to be for Kedusha. The bris milah means a covenant. It means a covenant. A covenant always means exclusivity. It means you and your wife only. Right? Only. Love, the bonding in absolute loyalty, always means that the tighter the bond is, the more exclusive it is of everybody else. Not because anything wrong with anybody else. That's what loyalty means. And therefore, a man who's gone against that element, okay, has caused this problem. A woman has this problem even more intensely. It doesn't say it in the same way that she enters Gehenna and Avraham Avinu pulls out. It's got nothing to do with the covenant. It's not the same issue of bris milah, of circumcision. But it's an area where a Jewish woman had a relationship, intimate relationship with a non-Jewish man, so you have very serious problems. She's forbidden to her husband after that. She's forbidden to the man she had a relationship with, even if he converts to Judaism. You have to understand these things. Again, this depends. Again, the halacha depends exactly on what the circumstances were and how much the person knew and so forth and so on and how answerable they will be for this fact. Okay? Again, and tshuva wipes it out. That's the good news.